in Holland. In front of a chapel was a huge concrete cross. The center of it was hollowed out. And in the center were chimes. Are there chimes in the cross? Music? What are the problems that is troubling the minds of man? Is this matter of unmerited suffering? It's been the pressing problem of the East. Merited suffering, we can understand. This is a world where we reap what we sow. It's a world where you get results or consequences. If you work with the moral universe, you get results. It'll back you, sustain you, further you, approve of you. You'll have cosmic backing. But if you go against the moral universe, you'll get consequences. You'll be up against it and frustrated. Some people go through life getting results. Others get consequences. You're free to choose, but you're not free to choose the results or the consequences of your choices. They are in hands, not your own. I can understand that. But what about this unmerited suffering? Where other people sow and I reap, you reap, we reap. It's at the place of unmerited suffering that the mind of man reels, rebels, cries out, "My God, why? My son, the world is dark with griefs and graves. So dark that men cry out against the heavens." What is the Christian answer to unmerited suffering? First of all, let us look at some of the answers that others give. We can see the Christian then in the background of that. There was the ancient Stoic. He had his answer. He said, "My head might be bloody, but it'll be unbowed under the bludgeonings of chance. I'll steel my inner life against outer circumstances." Very noble, but not good enough. Because in shutting out suffering, the Stoic had to shut out love and pity. Because if he let in love and pity, then all the world's trouble and sorrow would come behind that love and pity. Troop in, take over. Then there was Omar Khayyam, the great Persian poet, who reacted strongly against a world of this kind and said, "Oh, love, I'd like to take the sorry scheme of things entire and smash it and remake it according to the heart's desire." Lovely poetry. But you can't smash the sorry scheme of things entire and remake it according to the heart's desire. You've got to accept things as they are, modified here and there. Margaret Fuller once said, "I accept the universe." And the comment of Carlyle was, "Gad, she'd better." Nothing else to be done. Then there's the answer of Buddha. He sat under the Bo tree at Gaya, pondered long and deep upon the problem of suffering, and came out to the startling conclusion that existence and suffering are one. That the only way to get out of suffering is to get out of existence. The only way to get out of existence is to cut the root of desire, become desireless. Then you go out into that passionless, actionless state called nirvana, the state literally of the snuffed-out candle. I asked a Buddhist monk in Ceylon, "Is there any existence in nirvana?" He said, "How could there be? There's no suffering, hence there is no existence." Buddha would get rid of the problems of life by getting rid of life. Then there's the answer of the Hindu. He says that what happens is the result of a previous birth. so that whatever is just. If you're suffering now, you have been sinful then. As a calf will find its mother among a thousand cows, so your deeds will find you out among a thousand reapers. Accept it. It's yours. Whatever is just. Parenthetically, let me say, a good many Christians are turning to reincarnation as explaining the inequalities of life. Hasn't a line of scripture to back it? Jesus repudiated it when he said, when the people said, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind? He said, neither did this man sin nor his parents. The Christian has another answer for the inequalities of life. And they're not an hypothesis like reincarnation. Because I say it's an hypothesis. If you're suffering now, why shouldn't you remember what you did? If you're being rewarded now, why shouldn't you remember what you've done to get it? Reward and punishment and thought or good is not connected by memory. What kind of a remedial system would that be to reward you, but no remembrance of what it's all about? You say some people remember their rebirths. Well, I have my question marks. But suppose they do. Everybody should remember. Everybody should know why I am what I am because of what I've done. We don't have any leak of memory. It's a poor system. Besides, we have another way to account for the inequalities. And they're scientific and working now. First, inequalities are passed on through the bloodstream. Weak parents on the whole bring forth weak children. Strong parents on the whole bring forth strong children. Inequalities are passed on down through the bloodstream by innate heredity. Second, through the social heredity. Society is organized in favor of some and against others. So that many things are passed on through the social heredity. They make for inequalities. And the third is one's own choices. One may take advantage of what he gets in the innate heredity or in the social heredity and go up. He may not take advantage and go down. These three things account for them, and they're all remediable. Now, we can pass on a better innate heredity, a better social heredity, and make better choices now. A Hindu said to me one day, Jesus must have been a terrible sufferer, a terrible sinner in a previous birth. He was such a terrible sufferer in this one. And according to the strict law of karma, that's right. But I would suspect a premise which brought me to that conclusion. Then there's the answer of the Mohammedan. He says that what happens is the will of God. Accept it. Islam literally means submission. Submission to the will of God. But I question whether everything that happens is the will of God. If so, what kind of a God is there? His character is gone. Then there are two answers in the Old Testament. One, where Habakkuk says, although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither there shall be fruit in the vine, although the labor of the olive shall fail, and there be no herd in the stall, yet I will rejoice in the Lord and joy in the God of my salvation. Beautiful. But the usual answer of the Old Testament is, you'll be exempt if you're righteous. No plague will come nigh your dwelling. Only with your eyes shall you behold and see the reward of the wicked, for he shall not come nigh thee. The righteous would be exempt, but they had difficulty in fitting that in with the happenings of life. They found that the righteous did suffer, sometimes because they were righteous. Society demands conformity. If you fall beneath its standards, it'll punish you. If you rise above its standards, it'll persecute you. It demands a gray average conformity. The righteous are a departure upward. Their heads are lifted above the multitude, therefore those heads get whacked. And if they don't get whacked, they're not above the multitude. Jesus said, woe unto you when all men speak well of you. You're like them. When we turn to the New Testament, some Christians give that Mohammedan answer, it's the will of God. Or the Old Testament answer, you'll be exempt. Won't come nigh you. A professor walked across the streets of Chicago, knocked down by a motor truck, leg broken. After many weeks in the hospital, he came back and stood up in the university chapel service and said, "I no longer believe in a personal God." Had there been a personal God, he would have whispered to me when he saw me in that danger, but he didn't see me in that. He didn't whisper to me, so when my leg was broken, my faith was broken. He felt that if you were only righteous, motor trucks would not knock you down. Suppose the righteous should be exempt. What kind of a universe would we have? A very chaotic one. If a good man leaned over the parapet of a tall building and leaned over too far, the law of gravitation would be suspended. But if a bad man leaned over too far, it'd be in operation. You wouldn't know whether the law of gravitation would be in suspension or in operation, because you wouldn't know the character of the person concerned. Now, when I lean over the parapet of a tall building too far, I know the law of gravitation isn't going to ask whether I'm good, bad, or indifferent to put me down. It's a hard school, but I know the rules, and it's dependable. Suppose it could be proved that motor trucks would never knock you down if you were only righteous. What would happen to the character of the righteous? They'd become the champion jaywalkers of the world. They'd roam around amid the traffic, meditating and vegetating. And that quickness of decision which comes from a world of chance and circumstance would be taken away, and that exemption would be their elimination. Now, when I cross the street, I know if I don't belong to the quick, I'll soon belong to the dead. And so it sharpens my wits. And so I watch. In China, during the Chinese-Japanese War, there was a church that wasn't bombed, but the bombing, everything else around it, smashed. That church was exempt. And the people crowded in. Oh, they said, "This is the true religion." And so they all crowded in. Got so many people in that they had to build a new church. And the day they dedicated it, a bomb fell and smashed it. And rightly. Because if you had based religion on that, you would have said, "This is the place to be safe." How could a faith with a cross at its heart offer you exemption when the gentlest and purest heart that ever beat, the Son of God, was not exempt? Five classes stood around his cross and said, "Let God take him down. Then we'll believe on him." But God didn't take him down, didn't take him down. He dropped his head on his pulseless bosom and died. Then where is the answer? The answer, I believe, is right there in that cross. Jesus took the worst thing that could happen to him, his crucifixion, and turned it into the best thing that could happen to the world, namely its redemption. Jesus didn't bear the cross, he used the cross. The cross was sin. He turned it into the healing of sin. The cross was hate. He turned it into a revelation of love. The cross was man at his worst. And through it, Jesus showed God at his redemptive best. Is that the answer? Take what comes, good, bad, indifferent, and turn it into something higher? Not merely bear suffering, but use it? Yes, I believe that's the answer. I quoted that passage. Who did sin, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind? And Jesus replied, "Neither did this man sin nor his parents that he should be born blind, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him." I used to question that. Sounded wrong. Until a Japanese professor, mid-career, was suddenly stricken by blindness, retina detached. He staggered and reeled, went to his Buddhist faith. It said, "You sinned in a previous birth." He said, "I can't believe it." Somebody suggested that he go to the Christian scriptures, and to that passage where the man was born blind. He read it. Oh. He said, could the works of God be manifested through my blindness? Could I make something out of this? Could I use it? He opened his heart to the love of Christ, came out of it victorious, became a wonderful evangelist. People crowded to hear the man who took the worst and turned it into the best. He went to Europe, to Edinburgh, got a graduate degree, came back and has been a professor of theology in the Kobe University. Wrote books, loved, honored, respected. He didn't bear that suffering. He used it. Is that what we are to do? Yes. Where did those matchless parables of the lost son, the lost coin, the lost sheep come from? They came out of pain. The scribes and Pharisees says he eats with publicans and sinners because he's like them. Birds of a feather. He's like them. An attempt to take away his good name. Did Jesus bear that? No. He used it. He turned it. And you see through those parables the very heart of the seeking God. That attempt to take away his good name, he turned into something else, higher. You remember that case of the man with the withered arm in the synagogue. They watched him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath. He said to the man, stand out, stretch forth your arm. And he stretched it forth and it was well. And the scribes and the Pharisees were beside themselves with rage. And they took counsel to see what they would do with him. What they would do with him was to kill him, stop it. And then the account says, in those days, Jesus went into a mountain to pray all night. He came down in the morning and at daybreak, evidently he'd seen it in the night, what it was to be done. In the morning, at daybreak, he called his disciples together and chose 12, whom he named apostles. He said, all right, if they're going to do away with me, I'll entrust my movement into the hands of the 12. That was one of the most constructive things he ever did. He was probably going to do it sometime, but this hastened it. And he acted. And those 12, you know what happened. They filled the world with his teaching and his love and his power. Jesus didn't bear that attempt to take away his life. He used it, turned it into something higher. I watched an eagle circle over a valley in the Himalaya Mountains. I'd been interested in that eagle because I'd climbed a cliff and watched it feed its young. But this morning, this day, I was concerned as to what was going to happen to my eagle because there was a terrible storm brewing up the head of the valley. Dark, lowering clouds, the flashing of the lightning, the rolling of the thunder. What would happen to my eagle when the storm struck down through this narrow valley? Would it fly before the fury of the storm? Would it hide in the cleft of the rock? Or would it be dashed to pieces upon the pitiless rocks? The storm was now breaking. I watched breathlessly. The eagle did none of the things I expected it to do. It circled and wheeled and went straight toward the storm. And when the storm struck it, it went up, 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 way, way up yonder. Far above the storm, it circled in majestic circles above the fury of the storm. It didn't bear the storm. It didn't escape the storm. It wasn't broken by the storm. It used the storm. The set of the wings did it. Had the wings been set this way, it would have gone to the earth, bleeding, broken, blighted. But the wings were set this way. When the storm struck it, it went up. What does the Christian faith do for you and me? It gives you a set of the soul, an attitude of mind. It sets your wings so that when trouble and sorrow and difficulty and frustration strike you, you go up, not down. Same thing can strike two people. One writhes in the dust in agony and bitterness. My God, why? The other rises on wings of love into higher heights. It's the question of your attitude of mind and heart. The Christian faith then teaches you not to bear, but to take what comes and use it. Just as the lotus flower reaches into the muck and mire and takes up the muck and mire into the purpose of its life and transmutes it into the beauty of the lotus flower. So you and I are to take what comes. the raw material of human life, good, bad, and indifferent. Some of it pleasurable, some of it painful, some of it complimentary, some of it critical. And take it up into the purpose of your life and transmute it into character and achievement. I remember when this dawned on me, I was puzzled in India, and then I read this verse. And when they shall deliver you up before kings and governors for my name's sake, it shall turn unto you for a testimony. Oh, I said, can I turn everything, injustice, everything into a testimony? Can I use everything? And can I bear witness through everything? Yes, that's possible. If Paul had been out preaching all his life, it would be very beautiful, and that's what he wanted to do. But he got into trouble through his gospel and got into jail. And there in jail, he wrote those deathless epistles. Suppose Paul had been out preaching all the time. We would never have gotten his sermons, because there was no tape recorders then, no stenographers. But put in jail, and having leisure to meditate and pray, he wrote those deathless epistles. His sermons are gone. Those epistles live on. He turned that impediment into an instrument, his jail into joy. He did something with what happened to him. Just been in Finland. The Finns are a wonderful people. They were unjustly attacked by Russia. The whole Kerala peninsula was taken away. And 500,000 Finns had to be repatriated back into Finland. And they did it by a simple expedient. There are 5 million Finns, 500,000 have to be absorbed. And so they said, everybody give a one-tenth of his land or one-tenth of his money. We'll absorb them straight. They did. Then they had to pay a heavy indemnity. They paid it. Then they said they had to give them 64 ships, but the Finns were not shipbuilding. They had to learn it over again. But after they learned it, they said, and gave back the 64 ships, they said, why not keep it on? Keep on with it. So they did, and now they're a shipbuilding people. And they had to give a great deal of machinery, but they were not a mechanized people. They said, all right, we've learned how to produce machinery now. Let's keep on going. They did. So the Russians kicked them forward. Everything furthers those who follow Christ. If you know how to use it, everything in Jesus, everything is opportunity. Shall I repeat that sentence if you forget everything else? In Jesus, everything is opportunity. Because you can make everything into something else. Somebody said to me, all these criticisms you get, don't you get stomach ulcers? I said, no, I've learned how to deal with criticism. If it's true, I change. So I've made my critics the unpaid watchmen of my soul. They've furthered me a great deal. I owe them much. I'm grateful. But suppose it's unjust. I've determined that I wouldn't allow it to change my attitude toward my critics. As far as I know, I have no enemies, because I have no enmity. It's a very simple way to get rid of your enemies. Just have no enmity, and they're all gone. But somebody said, I don't believe you know when you're insulted. I said, yes, I suppose I don't. Because, as Luther said, my soul is too glad and too great to be the enemy of any man. It's simple. Use your critics. If they're right, change. If they're wrong, don't change. Love them still. It's simple. A woman who thought her home was intact and beautiful, their husband was faithful and everything was all right, got a telegram, a cable one day from Mexico. Divorced in Mexico and remarried here. Out of a blue sky. She heard that her husband had married a Japanese woman, and that they were now living in Okinawa, and they had two children, two girls, and that he had tuberculosis. She cabled her husband and said, "Please send those girls to me, and let me take care of them, so that your wife will have more leisure to serve you and help you." The children came. She took them into her home and treated them like her own daughters. Then she heard that the husband had died. And she sent a cable to this Japanese wife and said, "Please come and live in our home and take care of your children here and be a part of our family." And when the Japanese woman came to the airport, she said, "My one prayer was this, oh God, help me to accept her and love her with as much joy as I would if it were Carl, her husband, coming back to me again." And she said, "I did, by the grace of God. I took her into my home. And we became a real family of God." And she said, then she wrote at the bottom, "I'm the happiest woman in this block." In this block, yes. She didn't bear that. She used it. Professor James says this positive, active way of dealing with sorrow gives a new dimension to life. And Professor Royce says that no man is safe unless he can stand anything that can happen to him. Well, the Christian is safe because he can not only stand anything that can happen to him, he can use everything that can happen to him. And that is the victory that we are going to partake of this morning. It's all in the bread and the wine. Take it. Use it. Make something out of it. It's the open door.